Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Book 4, Chapter 11, The Law of Love. Having delineated the salient features of the true disciple, Jesus used three striking metaphors to show the 12 the great responsibility that they had incurred in following him. Ye are the salt of the earth. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set upon a hill cannot be hid. Salt gives savour to food, and, far more important, it saves it from corruption. Such is the vocation of the disciple, but only of the disciple whose character has been set forth in the Beatitudes. It will be the example of the preacher which will give authority to his message. A call to regeneration without the transformation of the prophet is worse than valueless. Disciples whose words have lost the support of their conduct will never save men from corruption. They will only bring shame upon him who appointed them. Their power for harm is as great as their power for good. But mingling with the world and saving it from corruption, they must also live above it. They are as light shining on high, spreading radiance far and wide. As a lamp illuminates the blackness, so they must seek out the dark environment where the gospel of love can be preached and the works of compassion undertaken. In the midst of evil, men must feel the contrast of their goodness. The emphasis in these metaphors remains where it has been in the Beatitudes, not on what the disciples do, but on what they are. Salt that is good inevitably exerts a wholesome and saving influence. Light which is not obscured cannot do anything but illumine the darkness. So disciples who show the qualities Jesus has described cannot fail to be worthy of him that sent them. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. It may be welcomed as a haven of rest by the weary traveller. It may be avoided as a den of vice, but it cannot be hid. A man who claims discipleship cannot be ignored. His profession has elevated him, and he stands exposed to the public gaze for good or ill. In all ages, men will assess Christ not so much by his precepts as by the lives of men and women they see and know, who profess to be his disciples. This is as it should be. Jesus told the 12 that this many-sided character, which would develop under his care, was not to be a cloistered virtue. They were men with a work to do. That work was the salvation of men and the glory of God. It would only be accomplished when they let their light shine that men, seeing their good works, would glorify their Father. With these metaphors, the course of the great discourse turned into the practical issue of how the disciples could translate the qualities Jesus demanded of them into terms of everyday living. The moral and spiritual standard of life was set out in the law. The 12, and perhaps even more particularly the multitudes who surrounded him, thought, not without some excuse, that Jesus spoke with an authority which set aside the law. His attitude to the observance of the Sabbath and the rituals of fasting and purifying gave them some ground for doubt. But Jesus now reassured them in the clearest terms. Think not that I am come to destroy the law and the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. He went on to establish for all time the necessity for obedience, even to the smallest detail, of the Lord of God. Failure to realize this will be reflected not in the expulsion of the disciple from the kingdom, but in his position there. Yet there was a far greater mistake than failing to keep the law, and that lay in misinterpreting the very nature of righteousness. The scribes and Pharisees were guilty of that, even whilst they meticulously obeyed its injunctions. This would exclude them from the kingdom. The righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was the exact opposite of the character that emerged from the Beatitudes. It was a righteousness which concerned solely with outward observance, completely disregarding the condition of the heart. The goodness Jesus portrayed was the response to the love of God, which transformed heart and mind. From this condition, good works flowed as an inevitable result. With specific illustrations, Jesus then showed his hearers the manner in which he came to fulfil the law. It was not in the sense that the Pharisees kept it by formal observance for their own glorification, but by discerning the spirit of the commandment and tracing it back from the circumference to the centre. The law said, "Thou shalt not kill." But murder is the last stage of a long process which begins with anger, envy, and hatred in the heart. It was there that Jesus attacked it. "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." It is easier to attack and defeat the germ of murder in the heart than to allow it to mature there until it bursts out into violent words and at last festers into ugly intentions. Thus Jesus attacked the source, while the law only protected men from the final outrage. The law condemned adultery, but adultery begins with a lascivious look. There it can be easily defeated in a short, sharp battle. Any thought can be dismissed by a determined "not wanted." Jesus teaches us to win our warfare at that stage. It will be done by the one who displays the qualities of heart which he has described in the Beatitudes. No sacrifice is too great to ensure purity of heart and mind in the powerful antagonism of the lust of the flesh. Rather than approach the dangerous waters where the law demands its penalty, it is better to pluck out the right eye or cut off the right hand. But these sacrifices will only be necessary where the first spark of passion is not immediately extinguished. Jesus went on to speak of divorce. His words here are only a part of his teaching on a subject to be considered later. He gave as a further illustration of his fulfilment of the law the question of oaths. The Jews held that their word was only binding when it was confirmed by an oath. Such an attitude served only to weaken men's sense of truth and stimulate irreverence. Once more, Jesus did not contradict the law, but he went beyond it. As in divorce, so here the Mosaic law made a concession to human weakness. A man swore an oath to impress upon himself and others the solemnity of his undertaking. But to the disciple revealing the qualities of Jesus had described, it was not necessary. Yea and nay were completely binding. There are no gradations of truth, no compromises, no subtleties. Nothing that will weaken the foundations of trust and confidence and lower the estimate of truth must be tolerated. Truth and reverence are the two things which become suspect by the emphasis imposed by an oath. They are the very things upon which discipleship is based. Jesus came into the world to bear witness to the truth of his Father's word. His disciples' calling is based upon that truth and the fear of God, which is the beginning of true wisdom. Finally, Jesus comes to the most powerful, the most practical, and the most difficult and exacting illustration of the deeper fulfillment of the Mosaic law. It concerned disciples' attitude to those who wronged them. No better illustration of the contrast between the law of Christ and the law of world can be found than in this teaching of Jesus, that the responsibility for reconciliation rests upon the one who is wronged, rather than upon the offender. There would be occasions when they would be confronted by men who physically assaulted them, who sought to deprive them of their goods, who abused their authority by making unjust compulsions. The law said that retribution should be exacted based upon the nature of the offence. Such a system of justice has found its place in greater or less degree in every civilized country. It has undoubtedly made a substantial contribution to moral and social standards wherever it has been enforced. But this was not enough for the discipline of Jesus. His Father was not moved by considerations of justice when he sent his Son into the world. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. The sacrifice that the Son was to make in a few short months bore no relation to justice. As his hour approached, he was to confide to these men, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." The supreme gesture of the Father and the Son was revealed in the love that they manifested. Thus, as an inevitable condition, the true vocation of the disciple of Jesus was to be revealed in the love which they manifested in their relations with men. Every day would bring them opportunities of doing this. They would be exposed to the malice of men. Because of their allegiance, they would be persecuted for righteousness' sake. They were to prove their discipleship not by refraining from retaliation, not by demanding retribution, however just, but by showing the same spirit as their Heavenly Father and his beloved Son. This did not mean that if a man struck them on the cheek, they were meekly to resign themselves to their fate. Indeed, they were to accept the challenge and fight back. But the fight was to be transferred to the higher battlefield of love. They were to turn the other cheek, to give the cloak also, to walk the second mile. That is action. But it is the action of love in which the disciple wrests the initiative from the offender and fights him with weapons which he cannot understand or resist. Jesus had already shown the 12, and he was to show them most clearly of all in his death, that it is only in this way that right triumphs over evil. Wrong has no answer to the assault of love. Justice may check it by fear, but love conquers it. A wrongdoer understands retaliation. He is prepared to accept the penalties which justice demands. But confronted by the offensive of love, he is either baffled and beaten, or he responds and is transformed. The redemption of the world has its foundation laid upon this divine principle. It was only by learning it as they heard it unfolded by their Master in his revelation of the Father, and as they watched it unfolded in his own daily relations with man, that they could begin to respond to the exhortation which was the climax of his whole discourse. "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father who is in heaven is perfect." Book 4, Chapter 12, The Law of Love, Continued. The disciples were continually surrounded by those who regarded themselves, or were regarded, as the true patterns of religious life. Jesus had told them that unless their righteousness exceeded that of the Pharisees, there could be no place for them in the kingdom of heaven. Now he proceeds to enlarge on that. He contrasts true and false worship in its three phases, in relation to man, God, and self. He begins by removing the veneer from the religious exercises of the Pharisees and exposing their real motive. Take heed that ye do not your righteousness before men to be seen of them. Theirs was a religious life born and sustained in self-interest. It gives alms, prays, and fasts, not as spontaneous expressions of devotion to God, but because they are the price it is necessary to pay for the good opinion of men. They pay the price, they receive the reward. The transaction is over. How different are the spiritual devotions of the true child of God. Jesus was revealing to them the great love of God towards them, a love that could only be satisfied by a responsive love expressed in worship and adoration to him, in good works to men, and in careful discipline of self. Such was God's claim upon them, and such was the only true motive for the performance of religious duties. Sincerity could, therefore, be the only test by which these devotions could be judged. There was a great need for the giving of alms. The act may be expanded to represent all the material benefits which they could offer to their fellows. But because of the source from which the action springs, the left hand will not know what the right hand gives. The gift will not be made openly to be seen of men, nor will it be done self-consciously to be seen of himself. The admiration of men and the satisfaction of self are twin dangers, which will only be avoided if service is a humble response to the Father's love. There could have been no display of hypocrisy more revolting to Jesus than the sight of the Pharisees standing in the prominent places of the city in ostentatious piety at the times of prayer. They loved to be seen of men. They had their reward. The true place of prayer was in secret when the door was shut and the soul was alone with God. Already Jesus had taught his disciples this by example rather than by precept. It would be impossible for them to remain unaware for long of his relationship with his Father. They saw an awareness of God and a dependence upon him which had not been seen since the days of David. They saw an even fuller interpreter of the heart cry of the psalmist, "As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God." They had seen Jesus return to them from his sleepless night on the distant hills, his step firm, his face aglow, a new glad light in his eyes, eager to face the arduous tasks of another day. No precept could impress them more than an example like that. But he told them that such lonely communion was to be the nature of their prayer. He gave them a pattern which disciples ever since have treasured as the Lord's Prayer. It obeyed the injunctions of its author in its simplicity. It focused attention first upon God and his purpose, and then turn to the suppliant's needs, limiting its request for temporal things to immediate necessities. concentrating more upon the needs of the heart. Forgiveness and the breadth of spirit to forgive. An appeal for deliverance from temptation and a final ascription of eternal power and glory to God. The prayer has been called the alphabet of prayer. According to our needs and circumstances, each of its sentences can be enlarged and developed. What vivid pictures are stirred into life by the brief petition, "Thy kingdom come!" What heart searchings, what earnest longings, what a challenge may be evoked by those simple words, "As we forgive." This prayer can be translated and enlarged into the terms of every disciple's life. It can lose its formality and become intensely personal. Yet if our spirit is right and our desire great, by repetition of its simple words, we can keep close to God in those barren days when we wist not what to say. The course of the great discourse turned on this point. And Jesus went on to discuss with his disciples something that was implicit in all that he had already said. He spoke of the difference in motive and outlook, and therefore in values, between the disciples as children of the kingdom and the children of the world. They had already seen from his opening words that their blessedness bore no relation to the earthly possessions upon which the natural man places such store. Their continued state of blessedness depended upon keeping unwaveringly to the standard of values which had prompted them to forsake all and follow Christ. In doing that, they had shown where their treasure was, and therefore where their heart was. The ungodly piety of the hypocrites had its reward. It was immediate and final because it was of the earth, and like all earthly treasures, subject to moth, rust, and extinction. As long as the disciples kept their perspective, their whole being would be pervaded with light. If it was forsaken, the whole spiritual vision would not merely be clouded, it would be lost. It was not only unwise, but impossible to serve two masters. There could not be two controlling influences in the heart. To set the affections on the world was to give up the kingdom. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. But in turning away from the world and avoiding the lust for its riches and rewards, the disciples were exposed to a lesser danger, the danger of anxiety. Of this Jesus now spoke, not in the severe terms in which he spoke of divided loyalty, but in appealing words of exhortation. He reminded them that they will not be destitute because they are not spending their lives seeking means of sustenance and comfort. The loving Father who had already provided them with a body with all its wonderful faculties, a life instinct with great possibilities, was both able and willing to maintain it. They had only to look about them to see not only God's creative power, but also his protective care. The birds banking and wheeling in the bright sunlight above their heads, the unconscious beauty of the anemones nestling among the grasses at their feet, their joyous witnesses of the provident care of their Creator. How much greater would be the love and provision he would extend to the highest work of his hands, especially those whose lives were dedicated to him and whose one great object was to give him pleasure. There was every incentive for trust and none for doubt. The great object of the disciples' vocation remained. Unmoved by the false glitter of the world's rewards, unhampered by anxieties concerning their daily needs. They were to lay up treasure in heaven, to serve God alone, and to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. But there is evil in every day, which no disciple can avoid, and each must fight. How is he to fight it? In language of great severity, Jesus told his disciples that it is a battle that begins with themselves. It is tragically easy for us to see the evils around us. We find little difficulty in discovering the faults of others. Jesus warns the disciples that the faculties that are so acute in perceiving another's weakness must first be used unsparingly upon themselves. There can be no more powerful discouragement to the tendency to pass judgment than the realization that, with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Even deep devotion and dedication to God has its own subtle temptations. Jesus warned his disciples against censoriousness by drawing the vivid picture of a man all but blinded by an obstruction in his eye, absorbed in the task of removing the veriest splinter from his brother's eye. It was an illustration which would probably provoke a smile, but one which they would never forget. It is a timely reminder of two disciples of each successive generation of one of the most insidious and prevalent dangers. It is also an exhortation to reserve their condemnation for themselves and their love for their brethren. But whilst Jesus gave his disciples this graphic warning against seeking out and judging evil in others, he also showed them the error of going to the opposite extreme and ignoring the existence of evil altogether. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn again and rend you. The disciple has to pursue the true course which lies between the evil of judging and the evil of squandering his blessings. It is possible to expose the holy things of God to desecration. Whilst his great work, like that of his master, is to preach the gospel by word and example, it is possible to do this work not only unprofitably, but injuriously. The secrets of God's grace and the confession of deep spiritual experiences can be recklessly divulged, bringing shame upon the word and needless persecution upon the unwise disciple. A wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. And to decide when to speak and when to forbear must be one of many responsibilities which are the accompaniment of divine privilege. The immature disciples may well have felt despondent about such exacting requirements and subtle pitfalls. Their Lord brings them fresh courage with his renewed assurance of divine help and guidance. Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. There is a sense of progressive intimacy in this threefold encouragement and promise. Jesus reintroduces the subject of prayer, but not now as a religious duty exercised with a sincerity which contrasts with the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, but as a power in the life of the disciple which will enable him to make true decisions, avoid the many evils which beset him, and keep his feet on the path of love and service which will lead him at last to the kingdom of God. Accepting this privilege, which will keep their hearts right with their Maker, Jesus showed that it would enable them to keep their hearts right with their neighbour also. Therefore all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. It was the complete vindication of his teaching that he had come not to destroy but to fulfil. His words are the positive attitude of love which he demanded of himself and required of his disciples. On this high note, the Master completed his description of the principles of the kingdom he had come to proclaim. He had shown the 12 the blessings which were associated with it, both in this life and also in that which is to come. He had not hesitated to set forth the price it demanded of them in self-control, self-humbling, and self-sacrifice. For this very reason, the great mass of humanity would find it unattractive and prefer selfish pleasures and temporary rewards. Only the few would tread the narrow path of life. But they were among those few, and to them his invitation went forth, an invitation as stirring and challenging as the "Follow me," which had preceded it. Enter ye in at the strait gate. In drawing the comparison between the two ways, the emphasis remained where it had been right through the discourse, not upon the destruction of the one and the life of the other, but upon the price it demanded of them. He appealed thus to all that was noble and good in them. Jesus warned the 12 against the false prophets who would arise in their midst, disguising their deceit in specious pretensions. Their efforts will fail and their identity be discovered if they are recognized by their fruits. Truth in the heart brings forth good fruit in the life. But the test by which the credentials of the prophet are proved is also the test which will be applied to the disciple in the day of account. There will be many professions of allegiance at the judgment seat, many eager recitals of works accomplished, but he will know by their fruit those who have responded to his precepts of love and thus done the Father's will. They alone shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Finally, the great discourse draws to its close on an awe-inspiring note. There will be a junction even on the narrow road. It is one thing to hear, understand, and assent to the will of God as set forth in the revelation of his Son. It is another to translate that assent into terms of everyday living. The man who hears and obeys has hard work before him. He digs deep into solid rock. With painful slowness and many setbacks, the building is erected on the foundation. But it stands firm against assaults from without and strains from within. The man who hears but obeys not, ignores the first essential of building. He does not bother about the foundations. He builds upon loose sand. However beautiful and imposing the structure may look, it shudders and falls under the impact of the first storm. This impressive parable with which Jesus brings to a close his charter of the kingdom of God is a solemn challenge to every disciple of every age. We are so familiar with this great Sermon on the Mount. We have known and loved its passages from childhood. Our very intimacy with it demands an answer which will determine our position in the day when the lawgiver and the mediator assumes the role of judge. Are we doers of the word?